ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tammy Shipley believed someone was out to hurt her.
I thought someone was after me and I wanted to just be safe.
She's put under 24-hour surveillance.
I tried to get in contact multiple times.
I'm taking my phone call. Nobody knows where I am.
And then something strange happens.
She just drank and drank and had something like 20 litres of pure water.
Ambulance emergency.
I've got a woman unconscious.
Tammy's story by Background Briefing. Sunday mornings at 9 on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen.
So when is a ceasefire not a ceasefire?
As American forces carry out further strikes in southern Iran, claiming self-defence, negotiators from both sides are at the table in Qatar.
But what impact is that having on the ground for people in Iran, with an internet blackout that's lasted months?
The fog of war has many victims, and often it's the people who need information most. I'm Latika Burke.
And I'm Kylie Morris. Welcome to Global Roaming.
Well, Kylie, the bombs are raining down again over southern Iran as Donald Trump reopens the war on Iran with a limited campaign in the south. But this is a bit of a gear shift from the ceasefire that we've had. And while not making good on his bellicose rhetoric about, you know, wiping out all of Iran, as he's done in the past, this is a troubling new stage.
It is. I mean, I think it's interesting the kind of language, the rhetoric that we're hearing from the Pentagon about this. They're calling these strikes self-defense. They are targeting, they say, missile sites and mine-laying vessels. So perhaps trying to speak to this being a kind of a narrow, closely focused campaign in order to allow it to proceed even as these negotiations are going on in Qatar, the new talks with negotiators from Tehran arriving there. Of course, President Trump has been talking about an imminent peace deal, but I've got to draw your attention to there was an unnamed White House official saying that the Iran deal is 95% done, but suggesting that the remaining 5% of negotiations are focused on Iran opening the Strait of Hormuz and turning over all nuclear material, which of course are the most difficult two elements to achieve before a peace can be realised. Greg Karlstrom, who's one of the Middle East correspondents for The Economist, wrote, "Well, I'm 95% done with a deal to buy a new house. The remaining 5% of negotiations are focused on the price and whether the owners are actually willing to sell." So this is a problem, I think, for Trump. And certainly we're seeing that kind of criticism within the US, that there aren't many people who are satisfied by the idea that Iran's nuclear future is something that is just going to be kicked down the road. And meanwhile, we'll get to a deal that will open the Strait of Hormuz. I mean, obviously, the Iranians are very unlikely to agree to anything other than that. But has perhaps Donald Trump been caught up in a fairly poor result here?
Well, I mean, this 95, I mean, it does invite the memes, doesn't it, Kylie? If only we could all get the final hurdles in the 5% of all our deal-making, we'd be in much better shape. But yes, I think trying to say they're closer to a deal when the nuclear issue and the Strait of Hormuz remains in Iranian control, they're nowhere near a deal.
Well, usefully, we've got an insight into life in Tehran itself today for this episode. It's very rare that foreign journalists have been allowed inside Iran to chart the course of this war and to get a sense of what things are like on the ground in the towns and cities inside Iran. And the ABC's Asia editor, Karishma Vyas, she's inside Tehran. She was able to secure a 7-day visa only from the Iranian government. She is working under restrictions, as you might expect in a situation like this. But she is able to spend some time with us today to tell us about what she's seen. Here's that conversation now.
Karishma Vyas, welcome to Global Roaming. When did you get to Tehran?
We arrived here mid last week, and it's been a really fascinating experience. It's my first time inside Iran. And we also happen to be here at a very historic point in this country.
And how freely are you able to move around, Karishma? I mean, working in Iran normally brings a certain set of restrictions. I guess in wartime, it's even more pronounced.
Yes, that's correct. Well, to begin with, it took us 2 months to even get permission from the government to come here. And the access has been quite rare. Only a few journalists, foreign journalists, have been given those visas. But we are working under restrictions, like you said. It's not like working in Australia or many other countries. We are required to work with a local media company that has been pre-approved by the government. Now, this company provides us with transport. They provide us with a local producer who helps us line up appointments and also acts as a translator. So those restrictions are in place. But in terms of moving around, we've been able to move around the city of Tehran, the capital, quite freely. We've been issued local press cards, as well as an important letter from the police saying that we have permission to be here. And these two documents are extremely crucial for us because we've been approached several times a day when we're out and about by plain clothed as well as uniformed security personnel who asked to see these documents. If we didn't have them, it would be a huge problem. We would be hauled in. But so far, you know, we haven't had any issues because of them.
And Karishma, what's your reality on the ground there been like in terms of what you've seen? How would you describe what you've seen?
Well, it's weird to say, but things are normal in Tehran, even though this conflict has been going on in the country for 3 months now. It's important to remember that Tehran is a city of almost 10 million people, and people have jobs to go to. You know, children have to still carry on with their classes. Traffic is, you know, heavy in the city. It's difficult to move around quickly. But underneath that, you know, it is a country that is in war with two of the most powerful militaries in the world. That's Israel and the United States. We have gone to locations that were hit by Israeli as well as American strikes at the end of February and into March, and the damage is extensive. We're not allowed to film military and police locations that were hit by these strikes, but we've also seen civilian areas, you know, residential areas where apartment buildings have been reduced to absolute rubble. And people have been killed. There's around 1,700 civilian deaths recorded because of these strikes. And you'll remember one of the most famous ones was the elementary school, where more than 150 or 160 elementary school students were hit. That was in the city in Minab. That's south of Tehran. But even across the capital here, there are sites with extensive damage.
And are you seeing any evidence of the deadly put down of the protests earlier in the year? Is there any sign of mass death or anything like that?
You know, no, there isn't. What we are being shown, I say that very specifically, are nightly rallies, pro-government rallies that have been happening ever since the war began on the 28th of February. And when we went, it in itself is a very interesting insight, right? Like that side of Iranian society, which is very pro-government, very pro the IRGC, the military, you know, the very strong military organization that is in Iran. And, you know, you go to these rallies and there's thousands of people waving Iran's flag. They listen to speeches that, you know, happen on stages. And they also shout down with Israel, down with the United States. And so that is what we're being shown. But there is certainly a large segment of the Iranian community that is not supportive of their government, but it's too much of a security risk for us as well as for the people that we would want to talk to for us to try and reach them while we're here under essentially surveillance.
Karishma, I guess it's hard to know whether or not there's more of a security presence on the streets now than there would normally be in Tehran. But do you have a sense that it is a city that is closely controlled beyond you and your activities? Are there plainclothes officers? Are there police? you know, keeping an eye on neighbourhoods. That's certainly what we've been told before.
Yes, there is definitely a sense of that. When we're out filming, I don't clock these security personnel often. And I'm caught off guard usually when somebody drives up to us on a motorcycle or, you know, in a car and starts asking questions. It always comes as a surprise. I'm not aware or cognizant that we're being watched when we're out onto the on the streets, but it always surprises me how frequently we are approached. Anytime we move to a new location, somebody will come up and you know, ask us questions, who we are and whatnot. So there is a heavy but invisible security presence on the ground. We certainly see some military vehicles in the squares that we're going to around Tehran, and these are the squares where the nightly gatherings are happening. So there are some obvious signs of security personnel, but most of it is happening by plain-clothed individuals. And because of that, I think there's a lot of self-censorship. There's certainly self-censorship on our part. We don't want anybody that we speak to getting into trouble once we leave. But I think that goes the other way as well. A lot of Iranians that we approach in the markets or on the streets don't want to be interviewed. They're much more open to being interviewed if we're doing simply audio interviews and their face is not used and we don't mention their names. They're much more comfortable speaking. But even then, there is a deep sense of hesitation and concern.
And what do those people tell you?
They talk about the economy a lot, actually. Like, while everybody is focused on this conflict, and of course that's making headlines all over the world, the real silent problem here, the real silent conflict, is how bad the economy is and how much people are struggling. Inflation is at around 70%, which is mind-boggling. But then you compare that to specifically food inflation. And according to the International Monetary Fund, that has spiked past 115% compared to this time last year. So you imagine basics like rice, eggs, vegetables, that is becoming simply less and less affordable for people over here. Unemployment is a real issue as well. Like, because of these strikes, a lot of businesses have had to close, and unemployment was already, the economy was already problematic before this conflict. It was because of the plummeting value of the rial against the dollar or the euro. That was the issue that kicked off those protests in December and January. That was the trigger for them. So it wasn't human rights concerns that initially got people onto the streets. It was just basic affordability and survivability. So that is what people talk about again and again, and how desperate they are for things to change.
I'm Kylie Morris. Latika is in Odessa, and our guest, Karishma Vyas, the ABC's Asia editor, is inside Iran for this episode of Global Roaming. Karishma, do you get a sense of how aware Iranians are of what's happening with the war beyond Tehran? You know, how badly damaged other parts of Iran might be, the Iranian strikes on the Gulf, what's happening in Lebanon, what's happening in the Strait of Hormuz?
They're very aware of what's happening in Lebanon. They're very aware of what has been happening in Gaza over the last few years. And the damage done to civilians, to those parts of the world, really feed into their anger that exists about the damage done to their own country by the war that started in February here. And they really see themselves as being on the receiving end of a great military power for no reason. You know, they say they did not start this war, it started for no fault of their own. In fact, there is a theory that is quite common that President Trump struck Iran because he wanted to deflect attention away from the Jeffrey Epstein controversy that is engulfing the United States, but also poses as a threat
Karishma, so do you have regular Iranians, sort of ordinary people, talking about Jeffrey Epstein?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that was really surprising to me. In fact, on the first day that we arrived, we were driving around Tehran and we noticed all these billboards. Usually when you go to a city, you have like, you know, clothing brands or the Coke billboards all over the city. Over here, these are propaganda billboards, and the messaging is very, you know, targeted towards being anti-American. But in one of these billboards, it was, I call it kind of like a series of America's great crimes, and it was pictures of like the bombing of Hiroshima, the slaughter of Native Americans, and one of the pictures there depicted young girls, children really, running around on Jeffrey Epstein's private island. And so this is very much part of the psyche in Iran, is that, you know, President Trump has been implicated in Jeffrey Epstein's crimes, or at least was a close association. And because he wanted Americans to stop thinking about that, he started this war.
I mean, that is wild to hear. What are you gathering in any sort of sense about how Iranians feel about the nuclear program, which is evidently going to be the key to whether this war stops long term or not?
Well, an interesting thing that has happened because of this war is that even people here who were opposed to their government have now kind of galvanized behind the authorities here because they feel under attack from an external force. So they, even though they don't support their government, they love their country. And that's easy to understand. They don't want their neighborhoods being bombed. They don't want their elementary schools being bombed and school children being killed. And so they have kind of, you know, united in some way. Like, you cannot say that Iranians are united in their support for their government, but they are united in supporting their country and not wanting to see it come under attack. As part of this nationalism, people are also supporting their right to have a nuclear program here. It bleeds into this nationalism that we're seeing, and that has existed in Iran for a long time, even before this war started. So when we speak to people on the street and say, well, would you be okay with the government here compromising on their nuclear program and their ability to pursue that, they say, absolutely not. It would be like us going to America and demanding that they stop their nuclear program, that America, Israel, or any other country does not have the right to tell Iran what it can and can't do with its own internal energy supplies, or its ability to pursue any program that they feel is beneficial to them. And they also, ironically, this attack on Iran may have actually increased Iran's motivation to pursue a nuclear program that is weaponized, because they feel that it would act as a deterrent on any further acts of violence against their country. So in an odd way, it may end up having the reverse impact of what the United States and Israel wanted.
So you mentioned going to a press conference by the foreign minister, but we know more broadly there's an internet blackout that's been in place for months across Iran. How are people getting their news about what's going on? Who is communicating with Iran's citizens on behalf of the government?
So the internet blackout is a major issue, and it's not just about the news that people are getting access to. It's also just daily life. We use the internet, we use the network on our phones, like in almost every aspect of our daily lives. So over here, my driver, for example, can't navigate through the city because his phone does not have Google Maps. So we are fortunate, in a very privileged position as foreign journalists, we've been given what's called a white SIM card. And this SIM card allows us to access international sites. Now, this internet blackout applies only to people's access to sites outside of Iran. Within Iran, they can communicate with each other, but of course that means that they're severely restricted in in their ability to just access news that's being given to them from, you know, local media companies. So it is a severe form of control. But, you know, certain government officials, certain businesses will have this white SIM card like we do. So ordinary people are only hearing and seeing what I guess is approved by the government, and people know, you know, it's not like news organizations are checking every story or every report, sending it to the government for approval. People know what they can and can't do.
I mean, I was going to ask you, when you go along to these rallies as a foreign crew, do you not feel any kind of animosity from people? I mean, it's a war, right?
It's a war. But the first question people ask us is, where are you from? And we say Australia. And there, even though diplomatic relationship between the two countries is really bad right now because of, you know, ASIO's report last year on these attacks on Jewish sites and Iran using proxies to carry them out, people have a lot of goodwill towards Australians. And, you know, they usually end their conversation with us by saying, welcome to Iran. So we don't feel any kind of animosity. But I think that also has a lot to do with where we're from. And also because it's so rare for them to see journalists, foreign journalists coming in, that they're really curious. People just come up to us and start chatting to our translator to find out, you know, what we're doing, where are we from. And so we haven't felt any animosity from anyone, even the security people that have approached us. Once they see our paperwork, again, they say, welcome to Iran.
Karishma, certainly some rare insights. Thank you so much for everything you're seeing and what you've been able to tell us today.
Thank you.
So that's Karishma Vyas, the ABC's Asia editor, as you heard, with a trip inside Iran, a place where access is very heavily guarded at the best of times, and these certainly are not the best of times, shortly to leave. But Latika, what did you take away from that?
I was fascinated by her saying that they were given special SIM cards, coloured white, so they could have better
the
access.
The white SIM card.
I mean, they. This is a regime that has really thought long and hard about how to implement restrictions on its people and is going about it in a very systematic and industrialized way, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, isn't it, when you're in a position like Karishma is, where she knows that what she's able to see and who she's meeting is being, you know, there's a gatekeeper with her effectively from the government. But what did you make of her commentary around the normalcy of life in Tehran?
You know, this was probably the biggest surprise to me, Kylie. But then again, if we think it through, why would the Iranians be letting in foreign media now? I mean, they weren't doing this when the bloody crackdowns were going on and people were dying in the street and being slaughtered. So it does make sense that once they'd restored order, that's the time they open up the doors and say, oh, you can come and have a very carefully curated look at how the city looks here in Tehran.
I think you're right in the sense that it reflects a level of confidence in the control that the authorities are still able to exercise over the population. And that is critical, isn't it, in terms of when you think about the motivations for this war, or as they were expressed, the idea that President Trump in the early days, this was about, you know, the Iranian people standing up and kind of loosening the yoke of the government and control. That certainly, according to at least the sliver of what Karishma has been able to see, that's certainly not happened. There's not evidence of opposition, and indeed the government is confident enough that they give foreign crews papers so they can go around the streets of Tehran and talk to people and, if you like, enjoy the protection or an umbrella of security from the government itself. So you could only really do that if you knew that you had everything locked down.
Yeah, definitely. I was also very taken by her comments about the reaction she gets when she says she's Australian.
The welcome to
Iran.
Yes,
but you know what? This also does fit, and we really do have to make very careful distinctions between the Iranian regime and the Iranian people, because, you know, it's my dream to go to Iran. I've never been. But everyone I know, including former foreign ministers of Australia who've made the trip, have said the Iranian people are extremely sophisticated, very open-minded, outward-looking, and very, very hospitable. That is something I've heard universally from every Westerner I know who's actually gone to Iran. And so I'm not really surprised that they are so welcoming and hospitable. That would seem very much part of their culture.
Even in wartime, though, I think that's interesting. Maybe, though, if Karishma's only travelling to parts of the city where people aren't directly impacted, it's easier for that welcome to stay in place. You know, certainly it would be an very unusual place if, for example, an American film crew were able to travel into the heartland of Iran and not feel any animosity when, after all, there are US and Israeli bombs that are landing inside Iranian territory, and indeed many civilians, as we know, have died in that process.
But unless, Kylie, they're capable of separating, just as we are, the difference between the regime and them. And I was also very intrigued by her comment, because we recorded an interview earlier this year on Global Roaming about how the society in Iran had pulled around each other, not necessarily against around the regime,
yes,
but around each other, yes. And that really accorded with what she was saying there about how there's this new nationalism and new sense of togetherness. So, complicated dynamics. Well, another fascinating chat that we've recorded here on Global Roaming. Lots of you are also very taken with the chats we're having. Steve has written in. He declares his email far too long to read out on it. You're right, Steve, it is a bit, but we'll share one section. He writes in responding to the Peter Varghese conversation played last week. He says, AUKUS is stalling badly. I reckon both partners would welcome a rethink of their commitment to supplying our subs. Likewise, I think we could view with fresh eyes our role, our geography, and most importantly, our agency, and are we on the right path? You interviewed someone a while back who made a lot of sense, describing the importance of shoring up our support and infrastructure and how that feeds back into the economy. It was intriguing. Another suggestion was we might upgrade our port facilities to host NATO vessels a long way from home. Both Ukraine and indeed Iran have shown there are many, often cheap, ways to deal with a large invader, and yet we're set to sink so many eggs into this one enormous basket that might even be obsolete when launched. I'd feel a lot safer if we started thinking more like a porcupine and less like a poor man's deputy.
Latika, I've got to say, Steve's not alone in those kinds of ideas being expressed by listeners in their feedback to us these days. I mean, certainly questioning the long-term investment in weaponry and technology of the sort that aren't necessarily winning wars in Ukraine and Iran. I mean, you're in Odessa. We had that great conversation recently with Jade McGlynn, where we were focused on drones and the difference they've made inside Iran. It might make Steve even more frustrated if he were to go back and listen to that episode. It is called "Is the Tide Turning in Favor of Ukraine?" But it does very much address the idea that, you know, perhaps it's these more cheaply made weapons that can be produced in the field that make a difference in this kind of modern warfare.
And if you like Steve, you'd like to write to us, please do. We love all your questions and feedback and ideas, by the way. Email is global.roaming@abc.net.au. Thanks to our producer, Rob Kelly. Hamish and Geraldine, back tomorrow, talking to veteran foreign correspondents Barbara Demick and Lise Doucette. Kylie, that's going to be a ripper.
It's a great one. See you.
Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.